Yeah. Okay, let's get started. Sorry about the technical difficulties. So, after 13 weeks of pretty flawless technology, we're actually having a breakdown with the video. So, we'll get started on audio only mode. So today is Advanced Signal Processing 2, and it's also acronym day. We're going to cover ocular artifact correction, that doesn't have any acronyms, digital filters, which are finite impulse response filters. We'll talk about latency, jitter, and Woody filters, there's no acronyms for those. PCA, scalp topography inference issues, BISA, IFA, and to conclude, we'll have a triple acronym trifecta. We'll have ERP with ICA and fMRI. Okay, just so you can say you got your money's worth here. Couple of announcements. I'm sure all of you here knew that the paper was due a few minutes ago, and the people who aren't here, I'm assuming, are still working on it. I will send you a commented graded paper back by email once all papers are done. So I'm not just going to dole them out slowly. I'll queue them all up and send them when they're all done. My goal is to have them back to you by the time your final comes to me, which is next Monday at noon. So at the end of class today, I'll hand you out the final exam, and you just put a hard copy in my mailbox then by next Monday. Also an announcement, if you look on the web page that has the podcast and the slides, there's also a link to the M script, the MATLAB script files, and some data that Mike gave us and linked that into the class. So if you want to play with that with MATLAB, you're welcome to do so. And the campus has a license for MATLAB, so you can use it freely. We'll also be doing another acronym today, class evaluations, TCEs, teacher course evaluations. We'll do those shortly. And we'll have some 3x5s. So if Mike is here, we're going to start with the 3x5s. And I'm going to hand it over to Mike. He was generous enough of his time to come back and answer the 3x5s in person.
Okay.
5, 10 minutes, like you said, would be fine. Hi, Ben.
That's your cue to say, hello, Mike.
Okay.
So thanks to you guys who sent me emails. They were all good questions, especially the ones about why I hate ERPs. So I guess a lot of people ask the question of what the hell are these imaginary numbers, what are they doing in my EEG scripts, and what do they have anything to do with anything? Well, just to remind people who haven't taken math in a while, the imaginary number is the result of this expression. It's the square root of minus 1. Now, the square root of minus 1 is not a real number. It doesn't make sense. It doesn't exist in the real world. It produces an imaginary number. So if you have something times an imaginary number, which a number is usually signaled by the lowercase I. So if you see something like 4i, it really means 4 times the square root of minus 1. So that's just what it is. Why is it useful? It's useful because of Euler's formula. This is Euler. He was just some French dude. I don't even know what he was. Actually, he looks sort of British with the white wig and everything. But this is his basic formula. E to the I times some phase angle, where I is the imaginary number. It's the same thing as the cosine of this angle plus the imaginary number times the sine of this angle. What that lets you do is it lets you take a real number, an angle, and project it onto the complex plane. Remember last week I showed you this complex plane where you have, instead of x and y on the axes, you have the real and imaginary. So to get from a real number into a vector on this complex plane, it's really simple. You just go e to the I times the real number, where the real number is an angle, okay, in radians. So e to the I times y transforms the real number line onto the unit circle, and it wraps it around with a period of 2 pi. That's why we saw that this oscillation, when you collapse across the imaginary domain, you get rid of the imaginary component, and you just have something that looks like it's oscillating back and forth on the real line. If you want to see that, there's a whole mathematical derivation behind this, and it really works, trust me. but I'm not going to get into it. Okay, so it's really complicated. The derivation is complicated. It's sort of needlessly complicated, I would say, certainly for anyone's practical purposes. So like I just said, using Euler's formula allows you to estimate the phase angle, which is the position along the oscillation through complex wavelet transform. Did I hear a wait? People are writing it down. Okay. I don't know whether this hurts or helps, but all you need to know is that the imaginary number allows you to get from a real number to a point in the complex plane. Okay? Can I go on? I guess these are online too, right?
Usually the 3x5s don't show up because they lay over the top of each other, so they don't display well.
Yeah. Here is another question. I presented quite a few different analysis approaches, and that's a tiny fraction of all the possible analysis approaches that are applicable to EEG data. And new methods are coming out all the time. If you look in like methods journals, like the Journal of Neuroscience Methods, at least every couple months, someone is thinking up a new ridiculous way to analyze EEG data. And very often sometimes in empirical papers, you'll see people developing their own statistical methods. So, you know, what's the right analysis? How do I know what to do? Well, the answer is yes. There are lots of analyses. There's no particular analysis is right or wrong or good or bad. Each is better suited for particular questions, particular assumptions you have about your data, particular things you would like to focus on, or particular questions you would like to address. But I think the key is that, you know, especially once you get into these more complex analyses where you're doing a lot of mathematical transformations and some of them are potentially weird and difficult to understand, if you see a finding reported in a paper or in your own data that only comes through, it only is statistically significant when you do these weird transforms and, you know, heavily select data, it's probably not a real finding. If you have a real solid finding in your data, it's going to be there no matter what analysis you do. So what's nice is when people can show the same general pattern of effects using lots of different analysis approaches, complementary approaches. Any questions about that? Can you recommend any books or papers or other resources for someone who wants to learn more about polar and Cartesian space and I guess more about all the kinds of things I talked about last week? The sad truth is no. As far as I know, there isn't really a good method. There are very, very complicated texts that are only useful if you already know what you're doing, in which case they're not that useful. Or these sort of dumbed down method sections of papers. But the way I learned and the way I would recommend anyone else learning if you're interested in these methods is you just read other papers, read through their method sections a lot of times over and over again, think about them, draw pictures on scrap pieces of paper. But the best way is to get MATLAB or some other math graphing, advanced calculator software and just get some data and start playing around with it and try to take the equations you see in papers and program that into some kind of language like MATLAB. And you can get all this stuff from the script that is posted on the web. So unfortunately, no, there's no good way to learn. It's just blood, sweat, and tears. How can we denounce ERPs forever? I realize I'm going against the grain when I say that I don't like ERPs because, pretty much everyone does. I do it too, I admit. But here's the deal. I mean, you know, there's tons and tons of frequencies in EEG in the brain, actually. The brain is completely oscillatory. You see it in EEG. You don't even need to do any wacky filtering or bizarre transforms or projections into imaginary space. You just look at raw EEG and you see all of these rich frequencies that are changing over time. The thing is that when you average EEG traces into ERPs, you discard a lot of oscillations, and you discard a lot of non-phase locked oscillations. The reason why this is, this looks like a sort of, you know, DNA strand, but really it's just two different oscillations. Exact same frequency, exact same amplitude, but they're phase shifted from each other, right? They're phase shifted by 90 degrees. So you can see that actually there are a lot of, you know, there's these really strong oscillations, but imagine averaging these two together. What's the result? It's going to be just a flat line. So the danger of ERPs is that you have things like this in the brain that you average over, you completely lose, you know, in the ERPs. If you do time frequency transforms, you will see this data. It's a questionable assumption whether you can really whether the brain works in the way that ERPs presume it to work. In the sense that the idea of an ERP is that there's all this background meaningless stuff going on in the brain. And then you have some event, like a perceptual event or a cognitive or motor event. And then all of a sudden this sort of, you know, this non-oscillatory and modular event takes place in the brain at a specific point in time, like this, and then it just comes to an end. You know, that's kind of the assumption underlying ERPs, but there doesn't really seem to be much data for that. I mean, that sort of doesn't really conform to, you know, our theories of how we think the brain works at the sort of fundamental neural level. So how come I hate ERPs? Well, you know, I don't really hate ERPs. I do think it's important to, if you're doing EEG research, I think it's important to compute ERPs and to display ERPs. They're not completely meaningless, and it's good, you know, ERPs, when you show ERPs, it helps people link your findings to other similar findings in the field and other papers and things like that. So the more I learn about the brain and the way that neural networks interact with each other and with themselves, the weirder it feels that people do things like average potentials. So I don't hate them. I just think that if you do these nicer oscillation-based analyses, you get a better picture, a more clear picture into what's actually going on in the brain. And I think that was it. Right. Question for John, that's not me. Okay, thanks again.
So the one question for me was a little more generic, which was on a scale of 1 to 10, how hard would you say the final week? I feel like I start therapy now. Well, it's probably a little late to start therapy now, but I'm hoping you'll find it reasonable. You'll see it at the end of class. Most of the exams I give for classes of this kind are pro-choice exams in the sense that you'll have like 30 things to identify, you choose 20 of them. You have, you know, 4 things to write about, you choose from among 8. So you'll have some choices here to kind of guide and, you know, go along with your interests. So I'll hand it out to you at the end. I don't know how long it's going to take people. I'm probably going to give it about a 7 on a scale of 1 to 10, okay? All right. Trying to imagine myself being a graduate student taking the exam. You know, challenge, but clearly within my grasp, okay? So, all right. So before we get onto all these acronyms, what I'd like to do is take just a little bit of time to handle course evaluations, and that'll also give us time, hopefully, to get the video fixed up as well. So to do this, I need to disappear from the room so I don't exert any undue influence over the process, and I need to ask for a volunteer to handle it. Okay, thanks. Come on up. There are 2 sets of these. There's not a distinction by 400 or 500 level, but there is a distinction for lecture and for lab. So if you're not taking the lab, you only want to do the ones for 401A. But if you are taking the lab, additionally, there are some for 401B. If there's questions about the instructor for 401A, of course, that's me. If there's questions about the instructor for 401B, that's Jim,
Okay, so for the lab, think of Jim as your instructor. Rate the whole experience, but comment specifically about the instructor would be for Jim, and I'll be able to give him those feedback. But then in here, the instructor would be me.
Let's just all do the ones for this class first.
There
and
you go.
If you're in the lab, then you can turn in the ones for this class. Take the ones for the lab.
Okay. Okay. Sounds good. All right. Well, thank you for taking the time to do that. So, given that we have quite a bit of stuff to cover today, we'll set our break to be break to be 10 instead of 15 minutes. Not that we're going to take it now, but I'm just going to set it up. We've had like four breaks already today, so we'll just set that to be a little bit shorter today. Okay, we'll start with the handout you already have from last time, and we'll quickly chew through that, and I'll have a new handout as well. So this is the handout that starts off with the time frequency representations like this. This is my only copy, but there you go. Okay, that's good. All right, good. Okay, so where we'll begin then is dealing with the impact of ocular artifacts and how to remove them from your EEG or ERP data. So ocular artifacts stem from the fact that eye movements and blinks create an electrical potential, and then that's propagated across the scalp, and we pick it up at all the scalp electrodes. In fact, you can see when you look at raw EEG often, the biggest feature in the EEG is the blink, because it's actually larger at the frontal leads than the EEG itself. And you can see it in the scalp EEG very easily. And the reason for this, I think we discussed briefly early on, but it's one of the things you probably quickly dismissed, is that the eye itself is not spherical. And, you know, it's mostly spherical, but it's a little pointed at the front, a little more rounded in the back. And when you have an object that's not quite spherical, but a little bit pointed like that, and the ionic concentration inside and outside are not the same, you're going to have an accumulation of potential. That accumulation of potential means that there's some positivity at the front and negativity at the back. So now you have these charged electrical dipoles sitting here, and they're capable of moving around, which cause electrical field changes. And you have this nice, moist eyelid that comes sliding across, just like touching your tongue to a battery. It dissipates the potential. And then you'll see with the blink, that potential on the front of the eye is propagated across the skull, or the scalp. So the blinks then are the effect of an eyelid having a sliding variable resistor across that voltage source, which is in this case the eyeball. Okay? Now, that wouldn't be a problem if these things were truly just random. You'd have a few more trials and they would average out of an ERP. But eye blinks are often systematic noise. They occur at systematic times with respect to the ERP signal. So if you're running a study, you'll often see, if you're getting codes for when the stimulus comes on, codes for when the person's response, you'll see stimulus, response, blink. Stimulus, response, blink. Stimulus, response, blink. And it comes right on the heels of the response, probably close in time to the time that they've actually made the decision about what it is that they need to do. And, in fact, the eye blink does signify meaningful psychological events in and of itself. There was a paper assigned early, right after the electricity exam, that we didn't have a chance to cover because we were running a little behind, but it's on the syllabus for you. It's by John Stern, who talks about the blink as indicating, it indexes cessation in information processing. And as an example of this, I'm going to show you some ads that are currently popular. What they do is they put two people together, they have a script, and what I want you to notice, they blink together.
When I was probably 9 years old. I remember seeing Jordan win it all.
Blink.
Mm-hmm. I made up my mind right then that was going to be me. That I was going to be part of that. Some dreams fade over time. Not this one.
Garnett blinks once more than James at one point. Maybe a little more dopamine on board. But you can see it came at predictable. It came at very predictable points in time. I don't think they actually had to do that, you know, to get people to blink at that time. If you ever, you know, you'll become conscious of this now, but if you're talking to somebody, when your sentence is done, they'll blink, if they're paying attention anyway, you'll blink. Okay, they occur at cessations in information processing. So now we go back to a typical ERP experiment. Information, process, blink. Information, process, blink. Okay, it's very predictable. Okay, so then these artifacts aren't going to be averaged out because signal averaging averages anything in that's systematic. And so if we think about this in terms of some vectors, we have an average waveform, which is just a vector, a function of time. And that average waveform is going to equal the signal that's invariantly present, that we think of as the, you know, cortical signal. Or if we think back to thinking of this in phase and time frequency terms, this is the phase walk signal that occurs across trials, plus the error on every trial, okay, and divided by the number of trials. So it's the average error. If this error is randomly distributed with respect to stimulus onset, then this term will sum to zero, and we're left with the average waveform just equaling the EEG signal that's there each time. But if this has some time-locked component, then we're going to average error in. And the ocular potential will be systematic error. It's not of brain origin, it's of ocular origin, but it is time-locked. So it won't average out, it will average in. Okay. So the other thing I'll just say on this slide, I think I've said most of it already, is that the blink artifact then tends to appear as a bit of a late P3-ish component with an anterior distribution, because it's going to be a positivity at the surface of the scalp. It's going to come right after information processing is completed, and the P3 index is often a good P300 latency is a good index of that, and so you're going to see it riding on top of the P300. So here's an example that we have. This is data at site CZ. These are unfiltered waveforms. Here they've been filtered with a pretty stringent filter. These are just two different types of stimuli. There are words that people know that appear infrequently, so they're rare, and there are items they haven't seen, calling them novel. Those appear frequently. And so what you can see is that here's the nice big P3 that you'd expect to the infrequent item, but then there's this thing out here that looks kind of funny. If you look at just the eye channel, here you can see the blinks seem to themselves be pretty well time-locked to the occurrence of the stimulus. The stimulus comes on right here, and we see out here about 600 milliseconds for the frequent and about 700 milliseconds for the rare, we get this blink, and it's time-locked. So it averages right in. Now we're going to talk about how to correct for that, but just moving ahead one slide, when you do correct for it, you can see now you get a much more predictable pattern here where we have the rare and the frequent stimulus. So if you go back, you can see you get a hint of the P3, but the novel trials, the frequent trials, are all screwed up. And when you correct for it, you get something that looks much, much better. Okay? So what to do? So you could certainly can reject trials during which eye blinks occur. That's not without its problems. So one of which is just potentially a problem in terms of what those trials really mean in terms of processing of information. Are trials on which people don't blink equivalent to trials which they blink? Okay. Since the blink may index something about the way they're processing the information, maybe those trials aren't equivalent. It's also a problem that you probably have to collect a lot more data if you're going to be tossing out a lot of trials. And often in these paradigms where people do reject blink trials, they'll tell people not to blink. But now you have a bit of a dual path. So subjects are saying, okay, don't blink, I press this for that for that, and don't blink. So the whole task becomes more demanding, and again, they may be approaching the task differently than they would if they were uninstructed. So many people will do some variant of eye blink correction, and I'll talk about a couple of different methods here, focusing mostly on the method that Gabrielli-Grotton devised when he was at Illinois. And this is a regression-based method and assumes that any effect of an eye movement or blink in the EEG can be inferred by recording an EOG lead very, very close to the eyes. You can see just what the eye is doing, and if you're looking at a differential amplification of a lead right by the eye, you shouldn't see much EEG there. It should be mostly ocular in nature. And so other models actually model those ocular potentials as a source and try to remove it. We'll talk about this a little later when we talk about ICA, for example. But for now, we'll focus on this kind of regression-based method. So this comes from the paper that Gabrielli-Grotton and Mike Coles and Manny Donchin published in 1983. And it's the schematic for how this thing works. It looks a little imposing, but I'll just walk you through it. So here we have a bunch of individual trials of an EOG channel. So if there's 100 trials, there'd be 100 waveforms here. And we also have 100 trials for any given site of EEG. And you can average those together, and you'll get an average ERP. It looks a little like the one I showed you before. There's your P3 and your later bump. And you get an average EOG. And then you go back and subtract from each raw trial the averaged signal. And the reason for that is that if you have time-locked activity related to brain activity, it could inflate this correlation. So now what you have are deviations from the average. So these would be blinks that occur a little bit off the prototype and EEG that's not time-locked. And what you then have is a very big matrix of EOG and EEG, so ocular and brain potentials, starting with trial 1, time point 1, all the way to the end of that trial, then the next trial, the next trial, the next trial, all the way to the last point of the last trial. So it'll be a very long set of numbers. You'll have a ton of data. And you can look at the regression to predict the EEG based on the EOG. So it'd be important that your EOG signal doesn't have much brain activity in, or you would actually be finding relationships between brain activity as well. And you'll get a nice, for a frontal site, you'd get something like this. For a parietal site, you would have near zero correlation. And then you can regress out the EOG contribution to the EEG, and you get a correction factor here. And so then based upon this correction factor, you take the raw EEG minus some factor times the raw EOG. It subtracts out a proportion of the EOG channel, and that proportion is determined by the strength of the regression here. So you're just trying to predict EEG based on EOG. It's a simple model. Okay. Let's see. And then, as I mentioned, you first of all take any event-related activity out because those could spuriously inflate the estimate. And then you create this scaling factor, and then you get corrected EEG epochs, and then you average those together to get the corrected ERP. Now, it often produces very good results, but you wouldn't want to just run this blindly and then take all your data and trust that they were fine. I'll show you how we might examine whether or not it's okay in just a minute. There's a variant of this that's implemented in the neuroscan system, if that's the system you're using, by SEMSLitch et al. It's very, very similar, but instead of taking out the event-related activity, they used a slightly different method. They decided to create blink-locked averages, thinking the blink won't be exactly time-locked to the stimulus, so if we line things with the blink, and then we have an EOG channel that's blink-locked, and EEG lined up the same way, that this might be a better way to do it. They produce highly similar results, and I think both are probably acceptable. Okay. So here are some data that I put together using the Gratone et al. Method. So this is at site CZ, and here we have, again, there's a frequent and a rare category. And this is without correction here, so this is the frequent here, there's the blink effect out here, and then the rare, there's the blink effect out there. This is, if we eliminate all trials of blink, this is what those trials look like. So you have kind of a classic P300 right here. The visual stimulus, it was a word, so it's about a P550. So that's what we'd expect it to look like in the absence of blinks. The Gratone et al. Method allows you to take the average data away from each individual waveform, like I suggested. And when you do that, this is the corrected data. So you go from this to this, and it looks pretty much just like the non-blink trial. There's also a function to look at. You know, if you don't do that pre-averaging, it doesn't really seem to matter very much. It looks pretty much like the trials without blinks. And then there's a residual path you can go through and correct for horizontal movements as well if you'd like. Now, this is a central lead, so it shouldn't make any difference, and it doesn't. So I just superimposed all methods here, and it looks like a bit of a mess. But what you can see is there's two kind of oddball waveforms here, and those are the raw waveforms. All the correction methods produce very similar kinds of results. Looking at site CZ for the same, PZ for the same thing, you can just see the effect of the ocular artifact is lessened because it's further away from the source of the ocular potential. So here are the trials without blinks, and then here are the trials that are corrected, and there's the ones with the blink. So if you superimpose them all, here's really the effect of the blink out here in this later post-P3 window. Okay. There are other ways to look at this. All these methods involve trying to subtract out some estimate of the EOG contribution. There were a few methods that looked at the frequency domain so that they calculated correction coefficients frequency by frequency, because it might be the case that different frequencies don't propagate the same. And then there are also methods that try to localize a source, or at least an equivalent source, of the eyes as a dipole. and take that out, subtract that out. I'll show you that late today when we do an ICA. So let's try this here. So you can actually see what it looks like. Okay, so this is set up properly. There it is. I'm going to move this window over a little bit. Okay, so here we have 32 channels of EEG data, and what you can see right here is very obviously a blink. And you can see the red all the way around the front of the head indicating a positive potential. It dwarfs everything else that's going on. And as you cruise along, not much happening. And here's another blink. And again, it just overwhelms the entire signal. And again, another blink. These two leads that go in the opposite direction here are channels that are below the eye. And then everything else goes in the same direction. Those are channels that are above the eye. And these are all referenced on... they've been re-referenced offline to average mastoid. Okay. So you can see there are clearly some sites that are suffering from a rather profound ocular artifact, like FP1 and FP2, for example. So what we can do is implement the ocular artifact reduction. You notice it's not elimination or removal, it's reduction. They're being kind of cautious. This will all be scripted eventually. You have to choose what channel. We're going to use the VEOG channel, which makes sense. That's a channel that is just a derivation like this, so it shouldn't involve much brain activity, only ocular activity. It goes in a positive direction, so it's going to look for positive going features. If you just happen to record things the other way, you could certainly look for negative going features. We're going to require that we find at least 30 blinks, so we won't call this a valid estimate. Blink duration of about 250 milliseconds. Blinks are usually closer to 300, but I'm going to catch it just on the short side. It seems to work better that way. And then you could review every single blink it finds, and you'd be here a long time, or I'm just going to review the maximum. So it goes through the file, it finds what it thinks might be a blink, and if it's the biggest blink, it shows it to you, and you can decide if that a blink or not. And then it goes through until it finds something bigger than that. It'll show you that, and it'll keep going until it finds something even bigger until it gets to the end of the file. So we'll be seeing those maxima as it goes by. And then we're going to save this as a new continuous data file here, CNT file, and it will also write out the coefficients, the linear derivation coefficients, and I'll show you what that looks like in just a second. It's just a set of weights that will be applied. So with great fearlessness, we hit OK. And now we have a bunch of squiggles, and the vertical EOG channel is right up here, plotting positive up. That looks like a blink. So I'm going to hit, you can't really see it here, obscured here, it should say press Y to accept, so I'll press Y to accept. Should see. There we go, and I'm going to accept that. That looks like a blink, yes. That's getting a little wide. I'll take that one. That looks more like a rolling eye movement, so I'm going to say no for that one. Okay, so that's the biggest thing it found. So now it's going to cruise through and identify all the blinks, line them up, calculate the cross-correlation between the blink average blink channel and the average of each EEG channel, and compute the correction coefficient factor. So there it goes. We see the dancing worms, as you like to call them. These are each and every blink that is found. You can actually see it as it goes. Now it's computing the regression. In the neuroscan time, you notice it's much faster than real time. Okay, now what we have here is the average blink-aligned, it's the blink-aligned average for the ocular channel and for every other channel. So you can see channels like FP1 and FP2 look very much just like the EOG channel. Okay. Now if I wanted to, I could also show the weight. So this is a topographic mapping of the weights. You can see there's going to be a large correction here up at the front. None of these numbers are negative, by the way. This range goes from 0.05 to 1.2. So the left vertical EOG and right vertical EOG under here are not mapped on this head. So you can see there's a big correction at the front, and it falls off pretty rapidly, and you're not going to be making much change at all at the back. So you look, for example, at a site like OZ, and we're going to subtract 0.05 of the ocular channel from OZ, so it's not contributing very much. But at a site like FP1, we're going to subtract 1.19, almost 1.2 times the ocular channel. Okay. So we'll say good, and we'll say finish. There we go. So now we have, make everything a little, okay, so now it shows you the uncorrected EOG channel, and then everything else has been corrected, just like that. So you can see the data are lined up exactly the same. If I also have it plot a nice head map here, and try to make it about the same size. Okay. So let's, for example, on the top map, you can see when I have a blink, I get that profound redness at the top. On the bottom one, there's nothing. The blink is affecting all these frontal channels, and after correction, there's really no hint of it. Okay. So, you know, visually, it looks like it worked. That would be a pretty good sign that it worked. But what you can also do is look at this artifact reduction linear derivation file, and this just says it's going to create 32 new channels from 32 old channels, and each new channel here is going to be some kind of a weighting of the old channel. So the vertical EOG channel is just 1 times itself plus 0 times everything else. But let's look here. FP1 is negative 1.19 times the vertical EOG channel plus, let's go off the screen here, it's 1 times itself. Everything, this whole diagonal is 1 here. And then you can see FP2 is pretty similar. You'd hope it would be since they're both, you know, right above the eyes. And as you go on down, you see again, as you get towards the back of the head, those weights are very, very low. So you should see the same kind of pattern across every subject. You can also have it export the standard deviation of those weights, and those should all be quite small. If they were too large, it would suggest there was some problem with the data. So it works pretty well. Any questions on that, or anything you'd want to see still? By the way, if you're working with NeuroScan and you try to do this in an automated way, there's this nasty little feature NeuroScan has that once you've marked a file for artifacts and save it, it puts some data in an event table at the end that's not supposed to be data, but then it treats it as data. And these numbers are enormous. They're like, you know, 50,000 microvolts, and it displays it at the end. In fact, I'll just show you this, so I'll save you some grief if you ever run into this. So at the very end of the file, here, okay, that's what we now call the CAE, the crap at the end. And the CAE is so large that, you know, it'll scan through, it'll say, is this a blink? It'll find stuff in this area, and you'll never be able to do blink correction because this is so large it misses all the other blinks. So I can mark it bad once I've opened the file and run the ocular correction like you just saw, and it works great. But if I would mark it bad and save it and then try to do something in a batch, well, when I save it, it writes a little bit more information in that event table at the end, and now it hasn't been marked bad. So I could open up the file and I could mark that bad, but then when I save the file, it puts a little more at the end. So you just keep chasing the CAE forever in NeuroScan. So this is obviously a bug, and you just have to, what we've done sometimes is to just epic the file, and then this isn't a problem. You can do blink correction on epic files as well as continuous files. So, okay. All right. So, any other questions on ocular correction before we talk about filters? Okay. So you've certainly seen the impact of some filters, but I don't know that you have until last week you didn't really have a sense of how filtering worked. So analog filters often work at the level of analog amplifiers, and they're working based on the principles you saw in basic electricity of a capacitor and a resistor, either in the capacitor either in parallel with or in series with the amplifier. But analog filters can actually cause a shift in the phase of the signal because they literally slow the signal to some degree, and not all frequencies will be slowed to the same degree. So you'll get some degrees of phase shift that vary as a function of frequency. And that would be a problem for ERP recording, because some components might be distorted, for time frequency phase measures, because some things might be altered as well. So what people tend to do now is record data as wide open as is feasible, just so you don't end up with any problems with the Nyquist frequency and aliasing, and then use digital filtering, because with digital filtering, you're actually doing filtering once the signal's already been digitized. You have a lot of flexibility. You can refilter it later. You don't have to make a choice at the beginning that you're stuck with. And there's no phase shift. It leaves things perfectly still in phase. And it's certainly been widely used for the last several decades. So Just to remind you, if we had a couple of individual waveforms, they were summed together, we'd have a complex, well, not terribly complex, how about a resultant waveform like this? And if you just had a couple of very simple filters, high-pass filtering would bring out something that looked kind of like that original signal, low-pass filtering would attenuate, but in this case it didn't eliminate the high-frequency activity, but it shows the low-frequency activity more dominantly there. Here's just a little more clear example. Here we have a longer series of data. It's got some regular oscillations here and some slower oscillations here. Actually, this turns out to be interbeat interval data from cardiac time series. And so this is RSA going on here, and then there's some kind of slow feature there. And if you filter it appropriately, you can get rid of the slow drift and just see the oscillations here. And again, that's a high-pass filter. And if you just superimpose them, you can see how there's no phase shift. Where there was a peak here, there's a peak here. Peak here, peak here. They line up perfectly. There's no phase shift at all. I was going to show you some examples using NeuroScan, but I think given the time, I hope you have an idea of what filters can do. They can show different aspects of the data. So the details in this come in the form of a handout. I'm going to hit the highlights of the handout as we go through here. I've also linked in this and one other handout I'll have today that are a little more detailed as little PDFs. There's a PDF icon on the web page with the slides and the MATLAB scripts and the podcast and now the PDF link as well. So we'll be talking about finite impulse response linear digital filters. And what they are is a series of weights that we're going to multiply our digital signal by in order to get a weighted value for each point. And those weights then can help us attenuate high frequencies or attenuate low frequencies or both in the case of a bandpass filter. So here I have two different 11-point filters because they just have 11 coefficients. These would be very computationally efficient, but they might not have the best characteristics. They probably won't have really, really sharply defined transition bands. And they have a half-amplitude cutoff frequency of about 17.5 hertz if your data are sampled at 200 hertz. Now what they look like, if you just plot the coefficients, this is our low-pass filter. It weights the middle point pretty heavily. Points on either side get less weight. And the high-pass filter looks a little different. It weights the middle point pretty heavily, then there's a little bit of negative weighting, and then it goes back towards zero as you move away from it. So this is just a series of weights, and what we would do is we would take those weights, and for the original data, we'd have to get in at least to the sixth data point, and that would be the first point we could filter. And the new sixth data point is a weighted composite of this number times the first data point, this number times the second, times the third, times the fourth, all the way up here. And you add up all those weighted combinations of the first 11 data points, and you have one filtered data point. It's the sixth data point, the middle filter point. Then you shift it over and do it for the next 11, and the next 11, and the next 11, and the next 11. It's just very, very repetitive. And if you have a lot of channels and a long filter, it can take a little while to do. Now, I'm going to show you in a minute how to apply that again. So these 11-point filters just mean they have 11 sample points. They're used in determining the new filtered value for any one sample point. So 11-point filter means your new data points, a composite of 11 weighted values. And you have a 201-point filter, your new data points, a weighted composite of 201 original data points. And the middle point of any filter, in this case the sixth point, is the weighted sum. These filters are non-recursive, meaning we always use raw data in the computation of the filtered values. Recursive filters can use already filtered values of the preceding samples in the calculations, but non-recursive filters are more straightforward and they're more commonly used. They have defined filter characteristics that I'll show you in terms of transfer functions in a moment. The term linear denotes that it's just the linear sum of these different weighted components. Okay. So it's just a bunch of weighted sums, and they sum up in an additive fashion. Okay. Now, digital filters, if you have a nice filter and you like it, but you sample data at a new rate, you can't just bring it over and expect it to behave the same. So digital filters are sample rate dependent. And these same filters would have very different cutoff frequencies for data sampled at different sampling rates. That's also be true with the wavelets you saw last time as well. Now, but once you know the characteristics of a digital filter at a given frequency, you can just convert it to another frequency. So what we had here, I showed you, was a 17.5 hertz filter at 200 hertz sampling rate. Just need to keep the ratio the same. So what would it be at 1,000 hertz? The answer would be 87.5 hertz. So it might be very useful at 200 hertz. Most of the time, people wouldn't use an 87.5 hertz low-pass filter or high-pass filter. It's not a particularly useful filter at that frequency. Similarly, if we had a 20 hertz sampling rate, maybe doing skin conductance or something, this would now become a 1.75 hertz filter. Okay. So if you have some filters and you're storing them, you know, coefficients, you probably need to store them away. You know what sampling rate they're tied to, or you could end up, you know, kind of wrecking your data applying it to a new sample rate. So let's start with a Mooey simple filter. This is a three-point filter, and this filter is then going to be a weighted composite of three data points. It's going to weight the middle data point half of the original value and add to it a quarter of the data point on either side of it. Okay, very simple. It's just going to be a little bit smoother. So here's our raw signal right here. You can see it's got a few jagged peaks here just to make things interesting. And, of course, we're not going to be able to filter the first sample because there's no data point before it. So the first one that we can actually filter is the second data point here. And that will be 0.25 times this, plus 0.5 times this, plus 0.25 times that. Then we slide it over, and to get the new data point for here, it'd be 0.25 times this, plus 0.5 times this, plus 0.25 times that. And then when we do that, you can see it just smooths things out. Okay, it's a nice little smoother like that. Now, when we have these filters, we want to characterize them then in terms of how well they pass certain signals and how well they attenuate other signals. And to do that, we'd look at a transfer function. So this figure comes out of the article by Ed Cook and Greg Miller that is linked to your syllabus. And what we look at is the gain from 0 to 100% or 0 to 1.0 as a function of frequency. So the passband is where signals are passed unimpeded. So in this case, this, you know, hypothetical filter, signals up to about 12.5 hertz are passed at 100% of their amplitude. They're not impeded in any way. Then there's a transition band where signals begin to be impeded and reduced. The filter is usually named for this 50% reduction. So this would actually be a 25 hertz half amplitude filter, because signals at 25 hertz are reduced to half their amplitude. And you can see finally out here, it's pretty much eliminated signals, and that would be the stop band where there's no signals getting through at all. But of course, these transition bands can be really, really sharp in cases of really good filters, and usually very long and computationally intense filters, or they can be pretty sloppy in the case of simple, shorter filters. The best filter usually is going to be one that passes all the signals you want, has a fairly sharp transition, and gets rid of all the ones that you don't want. So now if we go back to our Mooey simple filter, and we look at what's the transition band of this look like, well, if this were sampled at 256 hertz, oops, this would be our transition band. It passes signals in their entirety if they're under about 5 hertz, and then after that, it's got this really, really broad transition band that goes all the way out to over 100 hertz. So this isn't going to be a really useful filter for eliminating specific frequencies. It's going to do a little bit of smoothing, as we saw, but it doesn't eliminate a lot of frequencies. So specifically, the half amplitude of this one appears to be about 50 hertz, okay, at this sampling rate of 256 hertz. Okay. So what we'd like to see would be a filter that would come sharp transition like that. But to do that, we'd have to have something that's not such a really simple filter. Okay, so now I'm just going to show you on the next few slides some different filters and what their transfer functions look like. And all of these were for 128 hertz sampling rate when I did these. So this is called the impulse response, and it's what happens if you multiply the filter times an impulse, a single point. Okay, it's essentially the coefficients. Okay, somebody called it the impulse response. If you take the FFP of this impulse response, you get the transfer function of a filter. So that's nice. So you take the FFT of this, and you see what we have here is a low-pass filter. Half amplitude appears to be about 45 hertz or so. Okay. Now, the other nice thing about this, and this was detailed in the Cook and Miller article, is if you create a transfer function and do the inverse FFT, then you can get the impulse response. You can get some filter coefficients out of that. So that's the way, one way that you can design filters is create the transfer function that you want, do the inverse FFT, and then you'll get the coefficients that you want. So here we have a very different looking filter. It multiplies the center point almost by unity, and then there's very small negative values on either side that slowly go back up to zero at the endpoint. And that's a high pass filter. It filters out only the very, very slowest frequencies and passes everything else quite well. You notice this isn't perfect here. There's these little bits of ripple here. There are different ways of dealing with that I'll mention in a moment. Now here we have a more complicated looking filter. Again, the middle point's weighted pretty heavily, but now there's this complex series of weightings that go positive or negative just depending on how far you are away from center point. And when you do that, this ends up being a 60 hertz notch filter. So if you were to actually take the FFT of this, you'd see something like this. And then here we have another one that is a band pass filter. So again, weight to the center point about half, and then there's some ripples or some squiggles on either side that are causing weighting. So you know, you kind of think, as this slides across, if it catches things that are just out of phase with this, it'll end up, you know, getting them tapered to zero. Okay. Now, a couple of pragmatic concerns is longer filters generally are going to have sharper transfer functions, narrower transition bands. So that's good, but then they're also going to take, you're going to lose more data at the beginning, lose more data at the end, and they're going to be more computationally complex. So if you want a nice, clean transfer function, you'll probably need to sample some extra data points, and many if you want a very sharp roll-off, because the filter can't filter the first set of points before the middle point, which is the length of the filter minus 1 divided by 2. Okay. And so you might want to try your filter out, do an FFT on it, or you know, look at the transfer function and see if it really does what you want it to do. Now, there are a lot of filter design programs available now that didn't used to be available. So back in the last century when I was designing filters with a pretty simple tool, I found that you could design a filter to do one thing, but it wouldn't do everything you wanted to. So you can do something called a convolution. Mike talked about that last time. And a convolution is just filtering the filter. You take, you know, let's say you have a high-pass filter and a low-pass filter, and you know, we pass everything above 1 hertz and below 30 hertz, and we want to make a 1 to 30 hertz bandpass filter, you can just filter the filter with this convolving. And what you do is usually pad the ends with zeros so you don't lose any data points, because if the filter got shorter, it wouldn't be so good. Okay. So what that looks like here is I just had a couple of these things. This was a 2 to 32 hertz filter, so I had something that knocked off everything over 32 and everything below 2. Nice sharp transition band. I didn't do any windowing on this one. I just padded the ends with zeros, and you get these ripples like this. Okay, and it's probably not a big deal, but what it really means is that you know there's a little unevenness in how much it reduces these, and a little unevenness in how much it passes these. If you apply something like a Hamming window, and a Hamming window is just this kind of bell-shaped window to your coefficients, it smooths things out, but at a cost. Now this is not as steep of a transition band here, nor is this as steep of a transition band here. So there's a trade-off between having ripple and steepness with your filter. So if it were for some reason very, very important that you didn't in any way artificially exaggerate or attenuate any signals in your pass band, then you're probably going to have to sacrifice and have a slightly broader transition band in order to avoid that ripple. Or if you can accept the ripple, you can have a sharper transmission band yet. But you still see this filter compared to our MUI simple filter has a much nicer transfer function. Like that one would have just been going like that all the way across here. But these are 129 points, so they're pretty long. And those 129 points are at 128 hertz sample rate. So the filter itself is over a second long. It means you're going to lose half of that, a half second of data at the beginning and at the end. So you just need to account for that. In terms of how you sample your data. The other thing is that with really stringent filtering, sometimes you can even see things in single trials by visually or you can measure them. So for example, in an oddball task where you'd have, you know, once every 10 trials, some rare thing comes up, if you filtered it, say, a 5 hertz low-pass filter, you might actually see a P3-like component somewhere out there in the neighborhood of 500 milliseconds on an individual trial basis. So, let me see if there are questions you have about filtering. There are two pretty useful tools for designing filters. One of them is built into MATLAB's signal processing toolbox called FDA tool, filter design application tool, FDA tool. And the other one comes from Ed Cook and Greg Miller, from the same authors of the article that's on the handout, or on the syllabus. And it runs in DOS, and it designs filters. They can't exceed 1,023 coefficients, so that's their limitation, but they do a pretty good job. And they'll make exactly the filters that are described in the article that's on the syllabus. So I have a copy of that if you want to try that sometime. And as you saw with NeuroScan, for better or worse, everything's just built in. You can't import your own filter coefficients. You just design it with what they give you. You never actually really get to see the coefficients, nor do you really know the transfer function. It's just as a description. So you could probably, if you were a purist, send in some white noise to NeuroScan, filter it, and look at empirically what comes back out, what signals are attenuated, because white noise puts in all frequencies equally, and you could, you know, filter the white noise. But it would be nice to have the ability to really characterize your transfer function. Okay.
Rainy day reading?
Well, that's the detailed version of what I just went over. Or it should be. Put it this way, there's one question on the final exam that, if you choose to do it, you'll have a choice, is on digital filters. And if you read this, it wouldn't be rainy day reading, it would be finishing the exam reading, because you could actually do that exam question with everything you have here. So if you did the EPIC files and you overlap them, do you need to do filters on that?
Yeah.
So, when we overlap our filters, what we're usually doing is doing that for FFTs because we apply this window, the Hamming window, right? But let's instead say that we have some kind of a design where we're trying to do ERPs. So there's a stimulus here. There's a stimulus here. There's a stimulus here. Let's say they're coming every 1 second. So they're coming pretty quickly. Now, let's say we have a filter that itself is a second long. So it's a pretty big filter. So we're going to lose a half second of data. So with that in mind, we're going to have to create an epoch. So this is the continuous stream of data. And when we chop it up into epochs, well, we're going to have to go at least a half second before. And then let's say we're interested in 1,000 milliseconds after the event, and a half second later. So this, just for this section, we're going to have a data segment that's twice as long as this, because it's 1 second for the part we're interested in, plus the filter losing a half second on either side makes it 2 seconds. Now for this next one, again, we'd have an overlap, right? And for this next one, we'd again have an overlap. That's not a problem. That's how you would do it. And when Mike was talking about the edge effects in his time frequency plots, it's the same kind of issue. So he sampled data way outside of the plot that he showed you, where you get the edge effects as well. Because wavelets are themselves just filters. They're convolution filters that you're doing, you know, in very narrow frequencies as you go through. So they would have the same problem if you don't have data at the edges. Let's see if we can deal with some latency jitter, and then we'll take a break. Is that all right with people? Okay. All right. So, for people who hate ERPs, they might at least like this a little bit, okay? One of the issues with ERPs, as we know, is that we assume that there's this invariant signal present each and every time. And to the extent that it's not truly invariant, We won't see it in the average. And for these later endogenous components like P3, similarly, if P3 doesn't occur at the exact same latency on every trial, then it's not going to show up very well in the average. It's going to kind of move around. So to the extent that a signal varies from trial to trial, then it's going to give you potentially misleading results. It can either smear the component so that if P3 occurred on each and every trial, kind of without fail, what we might see is this beautiful, sharp, defined P3. But if it moves around a bit from trial to trial, what we might see instead is the early components will be locked, and then it'll just kind of be this broader mess like this, so that it appears to be lower in amplitude and broader in duration. But on every trial, that might not be the case. It just might be that on every trial, there's something that looks kind of like this, but sometimes it's here, sometimes it's here, sometimes it's here, and it moves around. And when you average it together, it looks like it's smaller. And of course, the other thing that we can see are these multi-bump components. This slide comes from one you saw earlier when we were introducing P3. There was a noise display of all those letters, and embedded in those letters were the word right or left, and people had to make a right or left response. And remember, we saw that there was this kind of, compared to the no-noise condition where P3 was very clearly lined up and nice and sharp, here there's an extra bump out here that might represent that P3 sometimes comes earlier and sometimes comes later. So, you know, it's a problem, and it kind of violates the assumption of averaging methods. So one solution is don't do ERTs, do time frequency work. But another solution, a long tried and true one, was proposed by Charles Woody, not this Woody, in 1967. And it's the Woody adaptive filter. And it's a way of trying to line up trials from trial to trial to identify how much they might have shifted and then realign them. So how do you do that? It's based upon a cross-correlation of waveforms. So this way we can, the assumptions of this are less restrictive than standard averaging methods. So remember, standard averaging methods was that the signal was invariant across trials. Only thing that's assumed here is that waveform morphology, in this case, for example, the P3 range, that the morphology is invariant across trials, but it can move from trial to trial. The latency need not be constant. Okay. So how does it work? It's based on a cross-correlational series, and if we have two waveforms, we can compute the correlation between those two waveforms, and if they're similar, it should be quite high. But let's say that one is just a little delayed from the other. So if we were to shift it, that correlation would be higher than if we didn't shift it. If we shifted it the wrong way, the correlation would be lower. So if we take two waveforms and we lag them back a little bit, compute the correlation, move it up, compute the correlation, move it up, compute the correlation, now we'll have a series of correlations as a function of how much we've misaligned those waveforms. And so if they end up lining up the best they possibly can, that correlation will be maximum. So you get this series of correlation values by increasing the size of that lag. So these are some extreme and fictitious data. And you probably never find a correlation of 1.0 unless it was the same waveform. But here's the idea that in this case, this would be something lining up with itself at zero lag. But you can see these two waveforms, this one in solid gray and dashed gray, actually correlate a little better. These are just two different kinds of data. You might think about different sites, for example. This waveform lines up best when the data are lagged by about 2 units, whatever units these would be. Same here. These also line up better when they're lagged a bit. And then when you move them too much, you can see it falls off dramatically. Yeah.
How do you know if you've met the assumption that your waves are constant across trials?
You probably really wouldn't. Right.
Is it a reasonable assumption to make most of them?
Probably so. Unless we think there's something about the actual generator of P3 that's going to prolong or shorten the process from time to time. But if we think what's really happening is it's just varying the time point at which this stimulus has been categorized. And if you subscribe to a context updating model or a working memory model, whatever the process is, that happens in kind of a defined period of time, then we should think that the P3 should look fairly constant across trials and just move around. Mm-hmm. So that's the idea behind this. So what we do then is we can actually use this as a template matching procedure. You can see how well the given trial match with a template. for those of you who used QRS tool back when we dealt with EKG waveforms, it's another way of doing that. You can see if you have a prototypic EKG and you slide it along and correlate it with the waveform, when you found the beat, it matches up perfectly and everything correlates very highly. Right? It's just another template matching procedure. But here, what we do is we take the average of EEG epochs, and then we take each raw EEG epoch and correlate it with the average. Now, only reliable variants will covary, so the random error variants that we think of as background activity won't correlate, but it should correlate most highly when it's lined up appropriately. This is also going to be a method of single trial signal detection. If you get a high enough correlation, you assume the signal is present on the individual trial. So you can create a template to start. That template can either be the average that you have. So admittedly, your average is going to be a little crummy if you think there's latency jitter, but you start with that as your template. Or you can do a predetermined template, like a half cycle of sine wave. That way, I'm going to create a half cycle of sine wave that's centered on 525 milliseconds, for example, and now I'm going to line everything up to that. That would be the other way to do it. And so then on the first iteration, then, we look at the cross-correlation series for every individual single trial with that predetermined template. Let's say it's the sine wave. And you get that correlation, and wherever it matches, at whatever lag it matches up best for a given trial, you move that trial. Okay? And then you go for the next trial, you see whatever lag it fits best, you move that trial. You line them up. And then you do it again. So now, you take the realigned trials, you average them, and you do the cross-correlation template to see if they'll line up any better. And do it again and again and again until some maximum correlation is achieved or some, there's a law of diminishing returns. You're not getting any more correlation as you go. You can also assume that if the correlation is not high enough, the signal's just not there. You can even throw it out. You can also use this as a method of determining latency of individual trials by finding out how much it shifted from the average, right, to get a good correlation. So this would be a way of saying on this trial, P3 was clearly later than on this trial, just based on how much you had to shift it in order to obtain a maximum correlation. So the way Woody does this is what I was describing, so that the template can be established at time one, but from there on it's iterative. You create the average based upon your trial, you shift, you recompute the average, you shift, you recompute the average, you shift, until things settle out. So the initial template, as I said, either a half cycle of sine, or you use a triangle wave, or the average of your raw trials. You create those cross-leg correlations on each trial over the range that you expect it to correlate. So if you're interested in P3, it might be from 300 to 700 milliseconds. You wouldn't expect it for the whole waveform. Because if you start shifting other components of the waveform and they get out of alignment, they're going to reduce the correlation, right? So you just look at this little window here. Each trial is then shifted to align it. And a new template's generated to average together those, and you keep repeating it using the new average as the template until the cross-correlation becomes stable. And you often look at the increment in the average cross-correlation from one trial to the next, and if it gets pretty small, like less than 0.005 or 0.001, which are correlation units, then you say, well, that's stable. We'll call it good. Okay. Also, if, some trials don't ever reach some maximum criterion, you might assume, the subject just didn't have a P3 that trial. The subject was asleep. The subject wasn't paying attention. You could actually throw those trials out based on a criterion like that. So here's what it would actually look like. These were data that didn't have a whole lot of latency jitter to begin with. This is site CZ. Here's unfiltered data. These are frequents and these are rares. Okay, same task with memory that we had. And now here we have filtered data. The red line is the Woody filtered data. And I guess what you can see, whether you look at the unfiltered or filtered data, is that this peak-to-peak gets a little bit bigger with the Woody filter. It lines everything up just a little better so that you can see there's a little clearer, if you want a difference, be a little bit bigger. Here again. Okay. Also, you notice the width isn't quite as wide here as well. So it would suggest there might have been a very small amount of latency jitter in these data because P3 in the non-adjusted trials is a bit wider than it is in the adjusted trials.
Mm-hmm. Is this something that you always do, or is this, when would you predict?
You'd usually only do it if you looked at your ERPs and it looked like P3 is really broad or your component's really broad or there's a couple of bumps where you expect there to be a single bump, or if a reviewer said, well, how do you know it's not there? It's not often done in paradigms that are pretty well defined and you don't expect a lot of latency jitter. It's usually done only when those are a concern. Last time we did it was, we had a paper where one condition was smaller than another. We didn't actually expect it to be so, so we wondered if it was more variable. So we did the woody filter, and it still was smaller than the other condition, so we ruled out the possibility it was just a more variable condition. And we did all this, and it became a footnote. Okay. So it does a pretty good job with a few iterations. And the original signal itself is singly peaked. If you had a double peaked original signal, then you're really out of luck because it might align to one or the other. You won't get any kind of convergence, right? And if you have too many iterations, at least one paper suggests there's going to be a decrease in validity. So woody filtering can only improve sigma de Roy's over a definite limit. And if you have too low of a signal to noise ratio, it doesn't have anything to work with. Again, it can't work. So you have to have something to begin with. And it's best if you have a, you know, a fairly large component like P3 that might vary, but it, the component itself is singly peaked, and then you can line it up appropriately. Now, with ICA that we'll talk about hopefully before we finish today, you'll see that you can see some variations from trial to trial, and there are other ways to visualize it. So the woody filter isn't going to be used as often as it was, but the general principle of using cross-correlation is one I think that, you know, you can see a lot of applications for. So I'm thinking you guys might be ready for a break, so why don't we take our 10-minute break. Yeah, if you want to put the tape in there, it's fine. All right, I think we have a quorum. So I was going to mention to you, a lot of papers came, you know, late this afternoon while I was finishing getting ready for lecture, so I didn't respond to you to let you know that I received it. But for those of you who sent it in earlier, you know, I send something letting you know I got a readable paper. You know, no comments on the quality of the paper, of course, but I just, you know, make sure that I can open the document. So tonight I'll try to get those out early tomorrow morning, so you should at least have something, you know, that you know that I got the paper and it came through in a way that I can read it. All right, ready? And also, before I forget, I want to thank Roisin again for the semester for schlepping the video equipment over here every day, running the equipment, so thank you very much. Okay, so another topic amongst the advanced topics is the question of how we might infer that two different conditions might involve different sets of intracranial generators, or put differently, maybe two different conditions in your experiment might involve different brain systems. That would be a useful inference to be able to make. And so, you know, one way of thinking about this, well, if there are different configurations of generators in the head, they should give rise to different scalp distributions. So maybe I can't say where in the head the EEG is originating from, but I can say that these two patterns wouldn't be caused by the same set of generators. So that'd be the logic. So maybe I have one condition that varies from another based upon a memory manipulation or attention manipulation. It produces a different scalp topography, then I could infer that different systems are being used. So that's nice, and so the assumption here is that if there are different source generators between conditions, there'll be result different, you know, scalp distributions between those conditions. And so what you could do is you would look for a scalp site by condition interaction in your ANOVA. So you're taking the amplitude of the component of interest at each scalp site, you run it through an ANOVA, and if you find scalp site by condition interaction, you'd infer different source generators. But there's a problem. And Wood and McCarthy detailed this more than 20 years ago, and that is that these scalp potentials don't propagate strictly in an additive manner to the surface. And so just the same source at different strengths can end up producing something that looks like an interaction in an ANOVA. So there are several graphs that illustrate that. So this would be sites across the head. Let's just say going from front to back. This is the amplitude of a component at a given site. So you can see these really look like they might be the same generator. They're maximal right here in the middle. They taper off. They have kind of the same shape to them. But if we just had these three data points, the three X's here and the three O's, we put those into an ANOVA, the lines that would be generated by them are not parallel. you would get an interaction, because when you have the non-parallel lines in an ANOVA, you have an interaction. So this would give rise to a scalp site by condition interaction, even though looking at it, you say, well, they might really be the same generator. So that's the problem. Okay. Here's another case. You might have a dipole that, you know, it switches polarity as we move to either side of where it's located. And so here we have, again, you know, say frontal to parietal and amplitude of the component. But here, the smaller source potential produces a line like this, and the larger source potential a line like this. You'd have crossed lines. That's an interaction in your ANOVA. So it's clearly a problem. And of course, the real case, where this obviously looks like two different sources, this one's maximal right here, and this one's maximal a little more posterior to that, now we'd have a line and this other kind of quadratic function in our ANOVA, and that would clearly look like an interaction. In that case, we'd feel pretty confident saying it's different. But all three of these conditions, only one of which would be consistent with different generators, they would all show up as a condition by site interaction in the ANOVA. So what to do? Well, wouldn't McCarthy propose a normalization solution where you normalize the data within conditions, so you scale them by dividing, for example, by the site of maximum amplitude. So we're taking into account overall magnitude differences between condition and now just looking at the pattern. And when you do that, it eliminates any overall condition effect, so there's no main effect anymore because you've by definition made the conditions equal in terms of their overall amplitude across sites. But now the scaled data would lead to something interpretable. So that if the interaction that you find in the raw data survives the scaling, then you might feel like you're more confidently able to conclude there might be differences in scalp generators. So if we go back to this one, so if we scale it based on amplitude, these lines would then superimpose. Or here, if we scaled it again based on maximum amplitude, the lines would superimpose. So that interaction would go away. But if we scaled these data, the interaction would still persist. So that was all good. We were all living, really happily and thought we'd solved it. Well, not we, but thought Wood and McCarthy had solved it for us until Urbach and Kutis pointed out, well, the solution really isn't the solution. It's not quite as tractable as they said it was. So if there's just one single source and it doesn't vary in its rotation, that solution is fine. But if the dipole were to rotate on a gyrus, so let's say that the difference between two conditions is just, you know, maybe a little bit of where that dipole is, this strategy won't work. And perhaps more problematic is when there are multiple generators, even if they're the same place, if they don't change altogether, but they change relative to each other, then all bets are off. This strategy is not going to work. And so they have a helpful diagram that Xerox very poorly on your handout. That shows this. So what we have here is, let's say, seven electrodes across the surface of the scalp. This is the box brain, I guess. And so there are seven electrodes, let's say front to back, here in condition one and condition two. And in this case, we have the exact same generator, some of them showing positive polarity, some showing negative. All those generators are the same. And in this case, every one of them is bigger in magnitude, both positively and negatively, than here, but the relative configuration has not changed. And so what we see when you superimpose the amplitudes that you get at these scalp electrodes is something like the middle case, the Wood and McCarthy case that I showed. And when you do the vector scaling, you do the scaling, the normalization, they would superimpose. And then our ANOVA would say, there's no scalp site by condition interaction. So we're safe there. Now here we have generator distributions that do differ in location. And so here what's happened is that this one has moved over a little bit. This one goes over to here for the second case. And so now when we look at the two sets of electrodes, you can see this is the raw and this is the scale, that we conclude appropriately that they differ. But it's this one that's nasty. So here, again, looking across the head, we have generators all in the same place. Okay? Every generator here is here. And everyone that's positive here is positive here. So that's all the same. But they don't all go up or down the same. So like this one went down a little bit, this one went up quite a bit. So they're changing their relative configuration. So this isn't hard to imagine as a plausible model, right? That there are multiple sources contributing to some process. And some of them are stronger in one condition than another. But they're all the same processes. It's just different weighting of them. Well, what we would see at the scalp surface then is a pattern like this, but when we normalize it, we still see that they look different, and we would conclude that there are different generators. So there aren't different generators, that the weights of the generators are different. Okay, so this doesn't really solve the problem in realistic cases where we have just more than one generator. So the Wooden-McCarthy case was kind of nice when you thought of there just being a single dipole and everything was happy, but when you have multiple generators, this solution is going to break down because you can't tell the difference between true changes in the actual source and changes in the relative strength of the source. So if and only if the Wooden-McCarthy procedure will produce valid inferences if and only if the two generator distributions are multiplicatively related. In other words, there's no change in relative strength across them. And of course, they're multiplicatively related if these three conditions hold. The locations of the generators are the same, the polarity of the generators are the same, and the intensities of the generators differ in overall strength but not relative strength. Okay, that was the middle case on the diagram. But how'd you ever know that unless you knew where they were? And if you knew where the generators were, you wouldn't be using an ANOVA to figure out if the conditions were different in the first place. So we're kind of stuck. So here's my take on it. I don't think all is lost, but I think what is the case is only one kind of outcome is definitive. So if you scale the amplitudes and there's no interaction between condition and site, then you're pretty safe in concluding, unless you have, you know, terrible, like, one subject or two subjects. I mean, if you have ample power, then here you get a non-significant difference when you scale, but you had, you know, maybe something before, then you they really aren't different, okay? Because if they produce the same distribution, maybe you could imagine some evil scientist going in there and moving a few dipoles around just to create the exact same distribution with different generators, but that's pretty unlikely. So if the ANOVA fails to find the interaction, power issues aside, I think you're safe in concluding there is no difference. Okay? But if the ANOVA finds the interaction, then you don't really know. Did the generators differ in location? Did they differ in polarity? Did they differ in their relative strength? So this is one of those rare cases where a non-significant effect might actually be more informative than a significant effect. Okay. All right, so this is another instance that we have to be careful. You know, we see these scalp maps, it's real tempting to think about, you know, this is a frontal effect, parietal effect, must be frontal cortex, this is parietal cortex. We have to be careful. We really don't know the generators underneath with any degree of certainty. All right. So I'm going to talk about another fairly complicated technique that if you've done factor analysis, this will seem very simple. If you haven't done factor analysis, this will seem terribly complex. Okay, so I'm going to warn you at the start. Principal components analysis has been used in different ways for several decades as a way of reducing the amount of data that we have with EEG data sets. So if you think about, you know, 20 subjects and 30 channels and, you know, 1,000 hertz sampling rate, you can imagine you have a lot of data points all of a sudden. And it might be nice to try to reduce the number of data points that you have. Okay. And that's one of the methods for doing that is principal components analysis. Okay. So to understand principal components analysis, we have to start out with a data matrix. These are the actual data that we feed into it. So there's each row here in this example is a subject, and each column is a time point. And so n is the number of subjects, little n is the number of sample points for an average. So here we're feeding in the event-related potential for each, or the ERP for each subject, and just t is the voltage at time 0, 1, 2, 3, so on. Okay. Now that would just be for a single channel. You can also have multiple sites by just adding rows for each subject. So subject 1, if there were 10 channels, would have 10 rows, and subject 2 would have 10 rows, and so on. And this is the matrix for what we call a temporal PCA, or a time point by time point PCA, but you can also transpose it for a spatial PCA, and I'll show you what that looks like in a moment. In looking at a matrix like this, ultimately you're going to compute a time point by time point correlation matrix, or covariance matrix. And you'll try to assess the extent to which across subjects, across electrodes, and across conditions, do these time points tend to covary? Do amplitudes at these time points tend to covary? And so if you thought about, you know, P3, there's a good 400 milliseconds of data where these points are going to covary quite a bit. One point's going to be related quite a bit to the next. Okay? And by doing this, the idea we could pull out independent contributions to the ERP waveforms. Okay? So that's the data matrix that we start with. And then what we end up with is a score matrix. And that score matrix now for each subject, again we have the same number of subjects we had before, where we have some number of components m that's less than the original number of time points that we had n. Okay. And then these are just scores on each component. And these are, each score is an optimally weighted composite of the original data so that it captures as much of the original variance in scores as possible in the early components, and then later components don't account for very much variance. So it's like in a factor analysis, you have a 100-item questionnaire, and the first factor might account for 50% of the variance, and a second factor 25% of the variance, and a third factor 20% of the variance. Now with three factors, you've accounted for 95% of the variance in your 100-item questionnaire. Same idea here, that maybe with three or four principal components, the score on these, you know, three or four components would account for over 90% of the variance. Okay. Now, another way you can think about this, just kind of as an analogy, I guess, conceptually, is, well, if you didn't do any kind of fancy optimization or data reduction procedure, I just took the amplitude at P1, the amplitude at N1, the amplitude at P2, N2, and P3. Now I have five scores for a subject. I've reduced the dimensionality of my data from 1,000 data points to 5 data points. Okay? And that's legitimate, but it's not going to be optimized in the way that PCA would optimize it. Okay. And so you get then these, PCA is going to give you these scores, and PCA is just a technique used to pull out these components. But you don't really know what they mean unless you look at the loadings of these components. So you get a loading matrix that for every component that you have, it has m components here, m, by n data points. So you now have, let's say you had 10 components and 1,000 data points. You just have a waveform that you can plot the loading. So this comes from one of the early papers looking at a time point by time point PCA. It was a P3 kind of experiment. And so here we have our loadings, and they're not loadings in the range of 0 to 1 like you often see, because they used a covariance matrix rather than a correlation matrix, in case you're wondering about that. And that's usually preferred for this. What we see is that here's a component that has its maximal loading somewhere out here around 250 to 400 milliseconds. I'm not sure, it could be kind of an N4 kind of component, for example. Here we have maximal loading out here around 525 milliseconds. It's probably the classic P3 kind of component. Back when I was confusing you about P3A and P3B with the Simons paper, he had PCAs. Well, this is what he had. He was showing you the loadings for these principal components as a way of trying to kind of clarify things. Okay. So looking at this, I could say, well, I'm really not interested. Here's a weird component. It just gets progressively bigger towards the end. I'm probably not interested in that component. Conceptually, I can't think of anything that would be. It's probably just sucking up some noise in the data. I won't pay attention to that. This 4, let's say component 4 here, again, maybe doesn't fit my needs, but component 2 really seems to, you know, capture the essence of the variance that I'm interested in. It's a P3-like component. Okay. Now, that's the temporal PCA. If instead you do a site-by-site input. So this is time point by time point, and you get a time point by time point correlation matrix, which is enormous, as you can imagine. Instead, you get a site by site. Now what you can do is you can plot the weightings of those components on different scalp sites. So each component has a weight on certain scalp sites. So I had a simple oddball task, and this afternoon I ran a PCA on it, and you can see the first component sure looks like it's a blink, right? It's got maximal weights right up here. Second component looks like the P3. It's got this parietal central distribution. And then the third and fourth components have some kind of lateral effects. I'm not sure what those are exactly. Turns out, though, these first two account for over 96% of the variance. So these are not accounting for a lot of variance here. Okay. They could be a little bit of lateral eye movements, maybe, that we just didn't get, you know, removed from the file. Okay. And then this just shows those same four components the time point at which they account for the maximal variance. You see number one here is way out here at about 600 milliseconds. That would be where they're blinking, right? Component two, the P300, in this simple task, which was just seeing a purple or a green rectangle, the P300 was actually around 300 milliseconds, and you can see this is accounting for maximum variance right here around 300 milliseconds. It's got a beautiful parietal central distribution. So based on that, I might say, well, Component one, I'm not interested in. That's my artifact. Component two, I am. Now, what's neat with this is you can reconstruct the original data matrix based upon any number of components you want. So based on this, I could say, I'm going to reconstruct my original data without this component. That would be a way of taking out the blinks. So this just reminds you of the data from which this came. I don't think here's the frequent condition. It's basically flat, in case you can't see the red line. Here is the P3 for the 10% oddball. Okay. So that's the data that give rise to this kind of a component here. Okay. All right, so now you can reconstruct the data. People want this off on? On, yeah, okay. Late afternoon. So we can reconstruct the data matrix that it's going to approximately equal the source matrix for the M components that we've retained times the loading matrix for the M components that we've retained. Okay? So we've probably made a decision to throw out a bunch of the components that don't account for much variance. And with PCA, the first component always accounts for the most it possibly can, and then whatever's left over, orthogonal to that, component 2 accounts for as much as possible, and whatever's left over orthogonal to that, component 3 accounts for it. So by the time you get out in 3, 4, 5 components, a lot of that stuff is not accounting for very much variance. Okay? And so to the extent that the M components account for most of the variance in the original data set, then your reconstructed data will look really good. And similarly, if you've identified a component that you really don't want, like that ocular component that I showed you right here, then we should see the reconstruction actually looks like a very good blink-corrected data set. I just didn't have time to do that before class to show you what it might look like. Okay. All right. Now, there are a few reasons to be a little bit leery about a data reduction procedure like this, and one of which is PCA is just a linear model, so it assumes these components sum together without any kind of interaction to produce the actual waveform. Also, it forces an orthogonality, and it may not be the case that, you know, everything in the brain is orthogonal. In fact, that would be kind of surprising if it were. Everything works independently of everything else. So if two sources are highly correlated, they're probably going to end up, you know, kind of defining a common component that reflects both of them. Also, it's tempting to think about these components as reflecting amplitude differences, but they just account for variance. So they can also account for latency variance as well. So latency jitter will end up producing principal components in the time point by time point PCA. So that PCA doesn't distinguish between variance in amplitude and variance in latency. And that's probably a real problem if you have like a pathological group and a control group, because your pathological group, you know, they have mental illness, they might be on medication, they might just be slower. So then you're going to have latency differences built in across your subjects. And pathological groups may be more variable and also delayed. So in that case, you could end up pulling out a principal component that doesn't represent an amplitude difference, but in fact a latency difference. Okay. So while in graduate school with Paul Collins, one late night sitting around doing a stats project, we decided, well, let's just look at this, because we were taking a multivariate stats course. So we simulated some data. We had a control and a pathological group. We just made our pathological group have a later P3. That's all we did. But otherwise, they were identical waveforms. They just differed in latency. That was the only difference. So if these reflected only amplitude differences, we shouldn't see principal components differences. But the two groups differed significantly on 3 of the 4 principal component scores that we pulled out of the PCA. So clearly, it was very sensitive to the amplitude, the latency as well. So if you just interpret these principal components differences as only amplitude, you're likely to be wrong. So you just have to be careful with that. Okay. Now, PCA is still used, but usually more in the spatial sense, not the time point by time point sense. But ICA, independent components analysis, is kind of a better spatial PCA. And the reason is that PCA finds these orthogonal components, and they suggest that the brain may not work in orthogonal methods. And these components are going to have orthogonal scalp distributions. What the ICA does is it separates things into temporally independent components to be the most independent that they can, but there can be overlap in scalp topography. So it's also known as blind source separation, but those sources don't have to correspond to anatomically distinct regions. What they correspond to is not hotspots per se, but maybe functional brain networks of how things co-vary and work together and how that manifests at the scalp. So there are a couple of tutorials that, because this comes kind of late in the class, that if you're really interested in this, you can work through, and the links are here. And this is all instantiated in the EEG lab toolbox for MATLAB and the ICA. So let me show you what that looks like. So here I did the ICA on the same data set I did the PCA on, instead of just showing you the first four, because ICA doesn't necessarily have the first account for the most and the second account for the next most. I showed you all 32 components. So for both PCA and ICA, for however many inputs you give it, you'll get that many components back out. So in a spatial PCA with 32 channels, you get 32 principal components back. Of course, everything after about four doesn't really matter in that case. In ICA, you're going to get 32 components back. Some are not really going to matter. And these are the projections of that component to the various sites on the scalp. So we can see here again, number one clearly looks like an ocular component. Number two looks kind of like a P3 component. Here we get maybe some lateral eye movement. Here's like another little piece of eye movement that we didn't catch maybe with the first component. This one looks like it's specific to one site. Maybe there's something kind of borked with that site, because if you get things that look like this, it's often picking up. Here's some activity that seems independent of everything else, and it's happening only at this site. So it's either a really important site, or in this case, it's probably something wrong with that site. Okay. So one use you can see with this immediately is you can identify components that relate to what you want, but just as importantly, you can identify components that relate to what you don't want and remove them, like in the case of ocular artifacts or bad electrodes. So if we look just at the four largest ICA components, they're number 1, 2, 8, and 10. Here we have the blinkish component, and it accounts for the maximal variance out here at 600 milliseconds, quite consistent with what we saw with the spatial PCA. Here we have our P3-ish component. It's the maximal variance right here, around 330 milliseconds, which is where the P3 was in this task. And then we have a couple of earlier components that seem to reflect something occipital, maybe related to early perceptual or attentional processing of the stimulus. Okay. Now what's also neat is that you can trial by trial project the independent component back onto the scalp. So here I projected it onto PZ, and this looks a lot like the plots you saw last week that Mike showed you, but it's a little bit different. This is, of course, time on the x-axis. But what we have on the y-axis here is trial. It's just, and the trials have been sorted. So what you'll notice is that there are about, 400 trials altogether. These 360 are the frequent, sorted from the first to the last frequent trial. These last 40 are the rares, sorted from first to last rare trial. And what you notice is that there's a whole bunch of activity right here. Look at that, right at 330 milliseconds. For the rare trials that you don't see for the frequent trial. And you can even see it pretty much just consistent across many trials there. So these independent components that can be back projected trial by trial are a useful way to look at trial to trial changes, because trial to trial EEG is very noisy. But if we pull out these components, which are independent of some of the other things going on, we might find a component that's related specifically what we want and be able to see changes in that in a meaningful way from trial to trial. And that was the basis for using this in the ERP and fMRI study that Debner and Ulzberger did that I'll talk about at the end, and it was on the reading list. Okay. So that's very briefly what ICA is about. Okay. It's a lot of these different components. I'll show you again a little bit more when we talk about it with respect to doing it simultaneously with MRI. So BISA is another acronym for analyzing source data. But BISA, Brain Electrical Source Analysis, is one that has a realistic head model and attempts to actually fit things in a spatial location. So PCA is a mathematical decomposition. ICA is a mathematical model. But they don't have any a priori assumptions about the head and where things have to be in the head. Okay. BISA, on the other hand, is an explicitly anatomical model. It has a head model, and it tries to localize things in three-dimensional space. So it's a model-fitting procedure where we try to estimate the intracranial sources that might underlie some aspect of the ERP. But it is an estimate, so we still have the inverse problem, right? That given a particular pattern of scalp voltages, we can't say definitively that this is the source that gives rise to it. There could be multiple sources, we just don't know. But we can say, kind of in a model-fitting procedure, if I had sources here, they would account for the surface data very well. Okay, so that's the logic that we have here. Does the model fit? But there's still no unique solution. Also, you wouldn't use this on ongoing EEG. ICA, spatial PCA, you can use trial by trial. The Bs that you'd have to use for the average, often you use on the grand average, just because there's too many sources and too much noise on the individual level. So, again, we have kind of a decomposition of the surface data matrix into these other matrices. A small complication here is has to do with the reference. So, BISA works on average reference data. So if you start with a certain number of channels by time points, those channels actually are, you know, an original number of channels minus the reference channel. So BISA actually comes up with an electrode by time points matrix, so that where the number of electrodes is the number of channels plus one. So it tries to recreate what your reference must be compared to the average of everything. And in so doing, you just have average reference data. So that's the input for it. The BISA programs that are available will often, if you don't give it average reference data, it will create average reference data for you. Okay. So now this matrix that has every site referenced to an average reference, oh, and it assumes, of course, everything's referenced to the same reference, can be decomposed into a set of sources, and these sources have a time voltage function, okay, and a set of attenuation coefficients for how they would propagate to the surface, so that now this surface data matrix of electrodes by time points is a coefficient matrix for electrodes by sources times the source matrix, which is the source voltage by time. So you have these time-varying sources that would be localized somewhere in the three-dimensional model. Based upon their geography, they would propagate to different sites with different coefficients, and that would produce the scalp matrix. Okay. So this attenuation matrix or propagation matrix is determined by the geometry between the source and the electrodes. So here we have like a single dipole sitting right under an electrode. That'd be a nice case. And it produces a very localized effect. Although that localized effect here would be if the skull didn't attenuate the signal. So this would be like brain, skull, and then the surface. But because the skull attenuates the signal, it's the equivalent of having a much bigger distance between the scalp and the source. So it would really look more like this. You see how it gets spread out more like this than it would here. So the geometry is important here. So this is, of course, a radial source. Here's a tangential source to the surface. Here's what it would look like if the skull wasn't being such a pain. Here, with the skull showing its resistance, you see, again, the effect. So based upon where it is with respect to the dipole, we predict some negativity and some positivity in either case. Okay. And it's also, the attenuation matrix is determined by the nature of the conductance of what they call a three-layer head model. You've got brain, which is highly conductive, skull, which is not so conductive, and scalp, which is moderately conductive. And so because the skull is less conductive than the layers on the other side, there's this spatial smearing, which is what I showed you on both of these cases, so that what would have been a very tightly defined effect if there weren't this spatial smearing by the skull ends up being quite a distributed effect due to the spatial smearing of the skull because it's not as conductive as the others. And that skull then produces the equivalent of a brain at 60% of the radius of the outer scalp. And, of course, the true figure is more like 84%. So the model has to, you know, kind of make it like the brain is smaller than it really is in the head in order to make this this fit. Okay. Now, some models just use a kind of standard three-shell spherical head model. More sophisticated models can actually take MRI data and, you know, use the actual MRI data in those coefficients. So, what we get then, this decomposition of the surface data into the coefficient or attenuation matrix and the source matrix, we get this electroanatomical time-independent coefficient matrix that just reflects how much does this source propagate to any given site. That doesn't change as a function of time. And then we get a time-variant dipole that each one of these dipoles changes its intensity over time. So you might see, here's a dipole that's maximal right at the same time my surface component's maximal, but it doesn't do anything in any other place. That would be a dipole potentially of interest. Okay. All right. So here's an example. This came from the paper we did using the error-related negativity. What we did is we fit data from just before the stimulus came on to 118 milliseconds later. We get this single dipole. It's symmetrical right here on the midline. It's located here in what would localize to be the anterior cingulate cortex. And it accounts for 91.4% of the variance, or 9.6% of the variance is unaccounted for in this time window across the whole scalp. So that's a pretty good fit. Anything under 10%, people usually regard as a reasonably good fit. Of course, this if we found this to count for similar amounts of data and had been over in the ear, we wouldn't have thought that was a very good thing. So it's obviously we take more data than just the fit to evaluate the goodness of this. Okay. So we have to look at, is it anatomically plausible? Does it make sense given what we know about damage in that area? What are the reviewers going to think about it, and so on. So now we've talked about several ways of decomposing data. So in our battle of the acronyms, we've got BISA, which is a realistic head model and actually attempts to place things in three-dimensional space. We've got PCA, which is kind of quick and orthogonal. And we have ICA, which is computationally intensive but maximizes things into temporally independent sources. The TCA and the ICA have these sources and propagation coefficients. And PCA solutions are constrained by orthogonality, as I mentioned already. ICA is constrained to find temporally independent components. Now, BISA solutions, though, are constrained by the geometry of the head and the volume section of the dipole and any anatomical constraints that the user dictates. So I guess what wasn't clear by what I said before, PCA, you put in the data matrix, you say, give me the PCA, it does it. It's a solution. ICA, again, once you've set up a few parameters, you put it into the ICA, and it gives you the solution. With BISA, you have to decide certain things, like how many dipoles do I want? Should they be symmetrical, or should they not be symmetrical? So there's lots of constraints you can put into the model initially. Oftentimes, people will try to put in just like a single central dipole or some symmetrical dipoles with the constraint that they can move, but they have to move together. And they can move their orientation, but they'd have to be symmetrical. Okay. So there'd be all kinds of other constraints. BISA might be a little bit more of a user-intensive exercise, and maybe there's a bit of an art to it. Because it's not a unique solution. Now, with any of these, the reconstruction of the original data will not be perfect based upon your limited set of principal components, your limited set of independent components, or your limited set of dipoles. But if your original data are reliable, you'll have a better chance of reconstructing them. If you capture important sources, you'll have a better chance of reconstructing them. And with BISA, one really good thing is if you think you have a really good source, you could try to upset the solution by inserting another source and see if it completely changes things. If you have a good stable solution and you insert another source, you let it run through the maximization, the optimization procedure, it really won't change the original source. Okay, the original source will still account for the variance and the new source won't suck up everything. If on the other hand it's unstable, you'll see the whole thing change and now it'll reconverge on some kind of fit, again accounting for the same amount of variance, but you have a totally different configuration. That would make me a little more leery that I have a good fit using BISA. Okay. Now, just to get kind of iterative with our acronyms, you can also do a BISA dipole localization on your independent components. So these independent components now have maximally separated things into their kind of temporal independent components, and then those can be actually fit to anatomical locations. Okay. That's still not a unique solution, but you're starting with data that might be cleaner and more limited in terms of what's contributing to it, so it might be a better way to try to localize than try to localize just in a time window, which is potentially going to have all kinds of things going on. You'd be localizing in a time window on an independent component. Okay. So BISA can be used in two different ways. You can have a strict hypothesis testing way where you say, knowing what I know about this component and animal models and this task, I think there should be a dipole in this region. So you try to fit the dipole in that region, and you test if it fits. Okay. Kind of like a confirmatory factor analysis. Of course, you can also use this in some kind of exploratory or optimizing manner by letting the program kind of find where the dipoles might be. So obviously, you'd want to validate that using some other method, but that would be another way you could start with it if you didn't have such strong constraints to begin with. And you can move your dipoles around, change the orientations of the dipoles, and change the time activity nature of those dipoles to try to optimize the fit. And these programs will allow you to adjust those parameters and maximize the fit. Okay. Now, in the end, if you do a visa solution, you're going to have to assess, did you think it really worked? And the adequacy is going to be judged by, you know, if your solution's stable, if you can't mess it up by putting in other dipoles, if you also see that it works across multiple subjects, so that, you know, you could fit it on the grand average, if you go back to every individual subject, and it fits on most subjects as well. Obviously, it has to be anatomically feasible. Inside the head would be good. In brain rather than ventricle, that'd be better. But also in terms of, you know, plausible in terms of, you know, something happening at that time window in that task that you think would make it anatomically feasible. And if you did follow-up tests with patients that had lesions in that area and you saw that they weren't able to do the tasks that seemed to depend on this in the ERP study, that would be even stronger evidence as well. And of course, ultimately, it'll depend on your reviewers, right? Do they think that you had a good solution as well? So you want to do a lot of your homework ahead of time to try to convince the reviewers that you thought about this as being potentially a non-plausible solution, and yet, you know, it seemed to survive a lot of these kinds of tests. So the final bit of acronym soup today is to use what we've talked about with independent components and a little bit of visa and doing an ICA on the EEG in the fMRI environment. Okay. So first of all, can you record EEG in the fMRI environment? The answer is yes, but it's pretty complicated. There's lots of issues. So there's two ways in which this can be a problem. EEG can be bad for fMRI, and fMRI can be bad for EEG. So EEG can be bad for fMRI because if your wires and electrodes were ferromagnetic, this would be trouble. They'd be sucked right into the scanner. So obviously, you don't want certain kinds of electrodes. That's probably not going to be a problem unless you're making your own electrodes out of some, you know, ferromagnetic substance. But a lot of them can be paramagnetic, which means, you know, they're going to show up on the scanner, and they're going to interfere with the homogeneity of the field, and they're going to interfere with your ability to see things. So the solution there is to get a non-paramagnetic cap. Here's one example of one, a carbon fiber cap that we were evaluating a couple years ago. The carbon fiber is conductive. Importantly, it won't heat up, which, you know, when you're, you know, giving these high-frequency radio frequency pulses, they're pretty big, and you can, you know, heat up paramagnetic material. It's not going to pose a hazard in the strong magnetic field, and it also includes an inline resistor to prevent any induced current from going back into the subject. So that's a really nice thing as well.
That one is very, very expensive,
yeah. Yes. That was like a $50,000 cap. Now, there are some other solutions other than carbon fiber that are less expensive that we're hopefully going to get this summer. Okay. All right, so that's one solution. Now, of course, MRI and fMRI can be bad for EEG. So this RF pulse creates a huge artifact. So anytime that there's a magnetic pulse, it will cause electrical field changes. And so here we have the effect of the pulse. So the scanner is on, it's pulsing, and it stops. It's off. Okay. So you can see that when it's on, you're not going to see much of anything. It just overwhelms the signal. So this is spontaneous EEG obtained from the scanner. RF pulse here, and in this thing, it's after correction. So I'm showing you that it can be corrected. But it would be this, you could also imagine it being on and then off. If you link the RF pulse with your own acquisition system and you know exactly when this RF pulse came, and better yet, if you know exactly what that RF pulse looks like, much in the same way as we regressed out ocular artifacts from the EEG, you can regress out the RF pulse artifact from the EEG. Okay. Now, the other problem is even independent of that RF pulse, so this would be at times not when you're actively scanning, but just in the scanner, movement in magnetic field creates current in any conductive medium. So you're in a strong magnetic field, and now any movement, you're going to see electrical changes in the EEG. So one of the biggest problems is the fact that people's hearts beat in the scanner, and we don't really want to stop that. So you can see here, this is, you know, thump, thump, thump. Every time the person has a heartbeat, there's this, you know, feature here that reflects the fact that they're just a little bit of pulsing going on. And they're moving in that strong, strong magnetic field. This just shows what it's like when it's been corrected, although it doesn't look like it's been corrected perfectly because you can still see these kinds of traces here. But again, it is possible to model the extent of the artifact and regress it out as well. Okay. This is a ballistic cardiogram artifact. Okay. And then finally, the high frequency current can make wires hot. And so this RF pulse is usually, you know, well over 100 megahertz at 3 tesla. And that's fast, and if it gets hot, that can create what I call megahertz. Like you really don't want that. So you need something that's not going to heat up and not going to conduct current back to the subject. Bada boom. All right. Okay. So those are some of the challenges. And, you know, I say it like, oh, of course you can do it. But to really do it takes a lot. And it's not just a turnkey, hit the button, and your artifact's gone, and now you have data. Okay. But assuming that you get past that step, then you could actually look at how a measure of brain electrical activity, of neuronal activity, correlates with these indirect measures like BOLD, hemodynamic changes, right? But you could do this by recording outside the scanner, just look at the amplitude, or even in the scanner at the grand average level. But it really wouldn't be optimal, because if it's done on the average, then you don't look at any trial-to-trial fluctuations. And it ends up confounding between and within subject effects. What we really want to know is, when there's more electrical activity, is there more blood flow, less electrical activity, less blood flow, right? But that would be a question to be addressed within a person changing over time. If we just looked at the grand average ERP and then the BOLD signal, we would say, do people who have more electrical activity in this window have more BOLD signal in this space, in this window? And that's not addressing the same question. So it's going to confound these within and between subject effects unless we can look trial to trial at the changes that are occurring. And that's what Stefan Debner, Marcus Olsberger, and their colleagues did in this paper that was published in the Journal of Neuroscience 2006. It's the final reading on your syllabus. So first of all, they were doing a standard error monitoring task, and they were getting ERN data. And then they pulled out an independent component using ICA that you now at least have a bit of familiarity with, and that IC corresponded to the ERN. So you can see here's the topographic projection of that IC. It's got a beautiful central maximum just like an ERN would. And this is the projection of that IC to site CZ for three conditions. They had trials where they were correct and some were compatible, some were incompatible. There's conflict. But most importantly, when they were incompatible, they made an error. You see there's this big potential. This IC projection really looks like an ERN. And they fit a dipole to that independent component, and there's that dipole looking pretty similar to the model I showed you with our ERN data. Okay. Prettier picture if they put it on a real brain, but there it is, anterior cingulate right on the midline. Okay. So that independent component seems to account for variance in the right time window. When you project it to site CZ, it looks like an ERN, and when you find an anatomical location using a dipole fit, it fits very well. Notice the residual variance, 9.8%, so it's under 10%. Okay, so that's nice. But these ICs then can be projected up on every trial. So every single trial now you can get an IC projection. So this is, again, a map of trials here on this axis, ranging from 0 to like 45, time on this axis. Stimulus comes on here. But these trials have been sorted by reaction time. That's what this line is right here. These are the fastest reaction time trials, and these are the slowest reaction time trials. And these are only error trials here. And you can see that that ERN kind of tracks the reaction time right there. So it's just following the reaction time. So you can see it's there on each and every trial. So the ERN is then visible without stimulus locking the trials and without averaging the trials. Okay? So what's interesting then is the single trial error-related negativity, the EEG, is systematically related to behavior in the subsequent trial. So when we talked about the ERN several weeks ago, I talked about how larger ERNs are associated with more likelihood of self-correction. But that was on a group level. This is the first paper to show that on an individual within subject basis, trials that have larger ERNs are going to have greater slowing in the subsequent trial. Okay. And trial-to-trial EEG measure also predicted the fMRI activity in the area that we would expect. So what does that look like? Here we have just a single subject example, and there are two lines here. These are all errors, but this line here, the negative slope with these filled-in squares, is the reaction time on the following trial. So when there was a more negative, ERN, which is actually the projection of the IC to site CZ. When it's more negative, they're slower on the next trial. Okay? So there's greater post-error slowing when the ERN is greater. And there's a greater ERN when they make kind of a more impulsive, faster response on the current trial, although that relationship isn't as strong. So it does show a trial-to-trial behavioral adjustment based upon brain activity that can predict it, and that's the first time we've seen this, but it makes sense given how we think about the ERM. Now here are the fMRI activation to all error trials, and we get something that looks like an anterior cingulate effect, but there's also these other things, like in any other study, there's always these annoying activations places you don't expect them. So, you know, what about those? Well, one of the things that was interesting, when they looked at regions that were just related to the ERN independent component activity, that cleaned right up, and this was the only region that came out. Okay? So those other regions weren't related to the ERN. They were related to error trials, but they weren't related to ERN activity on a trial-by-trial basis. So that shows really nice convergent evidence that that is the IC, that's the ERN, the dipole fit looks pretty good, it also fits right here. A lot of convergent evidence all in this one study. Okay. So that's like the coolest thing I think you can do. It's, you know, probably four or five acronyms in a single study. good stuff. Okay. I just wanted to have a short epilogue at the end of the class. So, you know, we've had a whole semester of psychophysiology. I don't know if this class has turned out to be anything like you expected coming in, but you certainly, I think, probably have covered a lot of ground. So this is just a couple slide synopsis on psychophysiology. So I hope you can see we've covered a lot of material, and psychophysiology spans a lot of different disciplines. It's a lot of techniques on the signal processing end. We spent a lot of time towards the end of the class dealing with that. But it's also interdisciplinary on the behavioral and psychological end. You know, there we link psychophysiological measures to social, interpersonal, intrapsychic, cognitive, emotional, attentional domains. And it's systemic that we've talked about all these systems independently, but at periods throughout the course I've tried to show you where things may link across different systems as well. Okay. And going back to the first chapter that we read for the course, I think we want to remember that psychophysiology is based on a couple of dual assumptions, that human experience and behavior are embodied and embedded phenomena. They're embodied in the sense that, you know, they don't behavior and experience don't arise independently of the physiological systems that give rise to them. Right? And that's what we can measure, we hope, with psychophysiological measures. And embedded, they're embedded in the milieu or the network in which they occur. So we shouldn't neglect the social influences, psychological influences, psychopathology, any of the nature of things that might influence our signals. Okay. And hopefully, when we get, you know, responses of the brain and body, when you study within the context of an appropriate design, you can illuminate aspects of behavior and experience that you couldn't get through self-report, through reaction time, through performance, through observation, in some other method. Okay. But having said that, you know, what we're still often obtaining are correlates of behavior and experience, okay, and psychophysiological correlates aren't really privileged in any way. They're no better or no worse than any other correlate until we do the homework to validate what it is that they might mean. So the utility of these correlates, like any correlates that we have in science, is going to hinge upon the construct validity of those, and that would mean we have to have a good experimental design, some strong theoretically driven hypothesis testing that would give rise to predictions that, you know, risky predictions that we can actually confirm or disconfirm. And ultimately, we'll develop a nomological net, a set of these interrelationships. So we have some construct, and that manifests in some physiological system that we measure with our physiological measure. And we put these together across multiple measures and across multiple paradigms, and then we actually have something that, you know, might teach us something beyond just there being a difference. So, you know, I guess another way of saying this is, it's often very tempting, and it still is to me even to this day, to say, there might be a physiological difference between those conditions or those people. But that isn't inherently informative. It's only informative when, you know, you develop this set of, you know, predictions and tests and a nomological network to try to make sense of it. I think ultimately what I didn't put on here are some of the most promising areas in psychophysiology are integrating across measures. So you certainly saw that with the Debner et al. Study at the end. But another way in which this can happen, for example, is linking brain events to autonomic signals. Right? We can look at when people show signs of arousal, when people show signs of different emotional experience, and we can look at event-related brain potential changes, we can look at time frequency changes, we can look at fMRI changes, linked to other measures of what's going on in the person. So I hope you found that useful. And I have just a couple mundane details then that I'm going to give you some exams here in a minute, and you should put those back in my mailbox. If you'd not bug the secretary as you go to the main office, you can just go right in and put it in my mailbox. That would probably be the best thing to do, because they don't like it this time of year. If, you know, you can imagine how many courses there are like this, and people are trying to turn in things to instructors. So just put it in my mailbox. It's the very top one in the mailroom, okay. Top left. I will email papers back to you after everybody's paper has been graded. And I'll also then, now that I'm done with the exams, I'll have final grades available for lookup using the web utility that I had for the electricity exam, and I'll email you when that's all ready. So, thank you. You've been a very attentive and good group. Thank you.